Hey everyone, welcome back to the Vet Blast podcast. We want to thank our friends from Attapet for supporting this great conversation as we're going to chat about canine diabetes management, treatment options, and monitoring. It can get a little confusing and overwhelming. And joining us is our wonderful colleague, Dr. Natalie Marks. How are you, my friend?
I'm great. So good to be back with you.
Thank you for being here.
Absolutely.
Such a common topic.
Yeah.
And can be a little frustrating at times.
Well, especially with dogs, right?
Yes.
Because I think most of us, when we think about diabetes mellitus, we're all about cats. And obviously, it is the year of the cat.
Yeah.
But with canine diabetes, we, of course, remember that it's more like a type 1 in humans, right? Mm-hmm. These are insulin-dependent dogs for life. Can be a really overwhelming conversation for a diagnosis. Sometimes it can be a little challenging, I should say more often than not, to regulate these patients. They can have comorbidities. So I really want to focus today on some of the more updated ways that we can not only monitor these patients, but also give those pet parents some peace of mind. There's some pretty scary stats about what people have to think about when they get a diagnosis.
Yeah. All right, let's get into it. So how common is diabetes in dogs?
So the, you know, the studies are not definitive. We have a little bit of a range, but it's thought to be 0.3% to 1.2% of the dog population. Now, that doesn't seem like a lot, but when you think we have 75-ish million dogs in the US, it is significant. So I would guarantee for those people listening, you're going to have a canine diabetic case at some point, probably more, in your career. And so I think as we consider this, not only is that something that all of us see, the incidence is rising because we know there are more risk factors like obesity. We have an epidemic, of course, in both canine feline population, but also pancreatitis, some of those comorbidities. And we're finding more about genetics that make us, again, a little bit more wary that we're going to see more canine diabetes as years go on.
Okay. And all right, let's talk about clinical signs. How do they present to us when they come to the hospital?
So these diabetics usually have at least two, three, probably four of the main signs that we see. Remember the four cardinal signs of diabetes: polydipsia, polyuria, polyphagia, but they're losing weight. So most of these dogs come in with some kind of myriad or kind of cocktail of those signs. However, in some of the more advanced stages, and I'm not talking our emergent cases, our DKAs, but the ones that have been kind of slowly brewing for a while, we can see pretty significant weight loss. So they can have a catabolic state because their cells aren't using glucose, so they're using fat and muscle. So often those spinous processes along the back of the spine are more prominent. They're losing fat pads. They're losing some of their orbital pads. So look for that. They tend to have a pretty dull skin coat and hair coat because, of course, the skin is the first place to show disease, the last place to get energy. Some of these dogs can have some generalized weakness and lethargy. More advanced cases, of course, can get neuropathy. So we can get that hind limb, almost kind of a paresis in a way, right? So they're kind of crouched down in the hind limb. They can be painful. We assume they have sort of that tingling sensation that we attribute, right, with humans with neuropathy. They don't tend to get that plantigrade stance that we see in cats, but just kind of that crouch down, think of like a German Shepherd kind of carriage. So all of those can be signs that we see, but again, those four cardinal signs are most common.
Okay, and how are they diagnosed?
Well, I think most of us are pretty comfortable looking for consistent hyperglycemia with concurrent glucosuria, right? High blood sugar in the blood, high urine glucose levels. There are concerns about stress-induced hyperglycemia in dogs, certainly not to the level in cats, but we want to have consistency of greater than 250 milligrams per deciliter of our blood sugar, and again, with that glucose in the urine. We can also see elevated liver values, so ALT, ALK, FOS, GGT. We can see elevated cholesterol and triglycerides. This is a big one that I don't want people to forget about because in some of our high-risk breeds, like Schnauzers and Bichons and Dachshunds, but these dogs can have an elevated level, pretty significant, of their triglycerides in the blood. And what that does, it creates a hyperlipemic system. So a lot of these dogs will get lipemic uveitis, which is a pretty nasty, very cloudy-looking disease, which, of course, any inflammation in the eye is not good, right? Predisposes us to glaucoma. A lot of these dogs, of course, can get rapidly approaching and presenting bilateral cataracts. Cataracts, of course, also an inciting risk factor for glaucoma. So we want to be looking for that as well.
And we know that there's some challenges along the way. So share with the audience a little bit about some of the challenges that we face when, diagnosing diabetes.
Yeah, so a couple things, right? First thing is, it's shocking. a lot of these pet parents are unaware that dogs even get diabetes, let alone what they're going to have to do. So challenges of just the emotional state of the diagnosis, certainly the financial challenges, the time challenges, the compliance challenges. We know that from studies right now, when pet parents get a diagnosis of diabetes, 10 to 40% of them consider quality of life to euthanasia. Wow. That's a lot. And then another 10% after the first year. So again, all of these factors play a role. And so for us as veterinary teams, it's really critical for us to be thinking about not only how do we present this diagnosis in a manageable way, how do we provide the best support to the pet parents so they have some peace of mind and confidence at home, but also just with the changing economy and the rising cost of care, can we be creative and present some spectrum of care options to them so that they don't feel like it's black or white, right? We can support them along the way.
And let's talk about some strategies when monitoring the diabetic patient.
Yeah. So one thing that we always want to remember is we have the advent of fructosamine, right? So remember, fructosamine is the average mean blood sugar over the last 2 to 3 weeks, more like three. Mm-hmm. So it's really a chronic measurement of our average blood sugar. This is a great test for us to send out if we want to just confirm, if you're like, maybe this is stress-induced hyperglycemia, you just want confirmation, but more importantly for our monitoring. So for those patients that are coming in periodically and getting blood testing. Now I want to talk about what I call the dreaded in-hospital blood glucose curve. For those of us that have been practicing a while, certainly that was all we knew. And we would have these patients come in and every hour we're checking those blood sugars. It's tedious. It is not emotionally friendly. And you better believe it, that dog or cat by the end of the day, if they weren't reactive from the beginning or having fear, anxiety, and stress, they were by the end. Yes. It's not an ideal situation. Now, sometimes that's all we have, or the client won't monitor or can't monitor at home. But what we do have now are continuous glucose monitors. We call them CGMs for short. And what that is, it's a medical device. Of course, many of you are probably familiar with the Freestyle Libre, which was sort of the first introduction to CGMs in the veterinary space. It is a human device that we've, of course, kind of, you know, we're the creative off-label kind, right? We've utilized for us, but validated to humans. But it allows us to trend real-time the blood sugar readings. Now, it's not actually measuring blood sugar. It's measuring the interstitial glucose, okay? So what that is it's in an equilibrium with the blood sugar, but there's a little bit of a lag time. So I want people to understand that if you measure blood sugar at the same time as measuring a CGM, it may not always ideally add up because there's usually a 5 to 10 minute lag time between the blood sugar reading and the interstitial reading, right? Can't happen identically. So just keep that in mind. But again, the trend is the same. So CGMs offer a lot of positives to you and advantages for monitoring. One, we get real-time, continuous, 24-hour. So are you worried about a Somogyi? Are you worried about poor regulation? Are you dealing with a potentially non-compliant owner where we're worried they're not even giving the insulin? Are we worried about insulin resistance? Mm-hmm. Huge thing, right? Yep. Very, very frustrating. That can be a clue, especially if you have prolonged non-responsive hyperglycemia, that can be a clue to us that we need to be looking for some of the common causes of insulin resistance in dogs, like pancreatitis, like a comorbidity, like hypothyroidism, Cushing's disease, like the probably the most common urinary tract infections. So it helps us catch those early so we can better regulate. We know that the dogs that are poorly regulated within the first 3 months of diagnosis have shorter survival times. Mm-hmm. So for us as veterinary teams, that first 3 months is critical for us to try to get the best regulation as possible. The other thing about CGMs, especially what we've taken from human medicine, is something called time in range, or TIR. So in human medicine, the TIR that's considered acceptable is more than 70%. That means if you have diabetes and we're watching your blood sugars for 24 hours, you should have the ideal range of blood sugar 70% of the time or more throughout that 24-hour period. That's obviously a great goal for us as well. And CGMs offer the ability to see the time in range. So you can see, is your dog in 100 to 250? That's where we want to be. 30% of the time or 80% of the time. Obviously, the higher we have it, the more successful in regulation. The really beautiful part about the Adipet CGM is, as I mentioned, the Freestyle Libre was to human validation. This is canine validated. So we have more accuracy as compared to the Libre. And again, you can feel very secure that this was designed for your canine patient in mind.
Yeah, let's talk more about this. So, you know, this is relatively newer. Mm-hmm. And so talks about that it was canine validated. What else is unique about it?
Well, again, very easy to apply. Yeah. And takes just a matter of minutes, certainly. I don't want to take all the sensors off here. The really easy thing about this is, for those of you that have been using a CGM before, this is going to be a very similar and seamless transition if you're curious to try this. Very similar technique. I think some of the things we want to keep in mind is we definitely need a significantly shaved spot. So you don't want to clip just a teeny thing. You know, a lot of pet parents can be a little weird about you clipping here. The hair will go back. Most of the time we place these between the scapula and the dorsal spot, or dorsal spine, lateral thorax if we have a deep chested dog, or like a dachshund where we have a limited spaces, but a long torso, right? Sometimes over the lumbosacral area, but we want to have this where it's comfortable for the dog, but out of reach, right? We don't want it to dislodge. The other key I want to make sure is that people are using enough adhesive. Some people are a little conservative. I usually say 12, 3, 6, and 9, if you're thinking of a clock face, to put that adhesive so we have a nice, firm, and attached kind of secure kind of place for that that sensor to be. The other thing that I think is important about this is there was a study done by ACVM in 2023 looking to see, we love it, right? Because we're getting tons of data. What do pet parents think about having a device like a CGM? And almost 80% of pet parents surveyed in a study where they were using a CGM as prescribed by an internist were not only had better peace of mind and more confidence, but went through therapy longer. Mm-hmm. Because they have this support that they're not alone. When we give a diagnosis of diabetes, especially to a pet parent who's unsuspecting and unaware and doesn't understand the disease, not only do we have to say this disease is forever, it's kind of like herpes. Diabetes in dogs is forever. It never goes away. It's forever. It's insulin. It's monitoring. So not only do they have to consider and will have to give injections once or twice a day indefinitely, they're going to have rechecks. We have to monitor. If they're not using CGM, they're going to be checking blood sugars periodically, indefinitely. Their life changes completely. Yeah, I mean, it's so heavy. Mm-hmm. So putting this on when you're going over that diagnosis, when they're starting insulin, pet parents just do, I have something that's helping me. My vet is connected to me, mm-hmm. right? We have the data. We get the trends. We can adjust. What's important about any CGM is we do have to have rules with the pet parent. We don't want the pet parent to be adjusting insulin at home based on CGMs. We want them to know fluctuations mildly in blood sugar is normal. We're looking for ranges and trends. So they need to be contacting us. We'll be getting that data, of course, on the dashboard, but it's important for them to sort of not be taking, this is not the sort of their kind of freedom to take the insulin dosing into their own hands. It's more so that we can feel connected, we're a team, and we can adjust more proactively rather than waiting 3 months and the patient's not doing well.
And how long is it on the dog for?
So most CGMs are good for about 2 weeks. Okay. About 70% of dog CGMs make it that long, maximum time. Usually it's about 7 to 9 days on average, but they're made to last about 2 weeks. To be honest, a week is a great time. Like for me, I stress, if we can get a week of continuous blood sugar readings when you've done an adjustment of dose, you're going to be able to see, right? Most of our intermediate acting insulin, so I'm going to just use Vetsulin as an option, right, are going to be once to twice daily. So if you're adjusting dose, you'll see what you need within that week. A lot of people are switching over to Levemir or Detemir, which is a much more potent and longer acting insulin. It's come over from human. The nice thing about it is there's limited bioavailability variability. What I mean by that is what works in most dogs is going to work in most dogs. It's not individual dog to dog. And we get a nice flat profile. So within a couple days, you're going to know if that insulin is changing that blood sugar regulation. There are some newer, even ultra long acting insulins that you might see from a specialist that's being tested. One is Traceba. It can actually last beyond 42 hours. Mm. So ultra long acting, that is not in commonplace and certainly off label for frontline veterinary teams. But in the specialist space, they are playing around with this a little bit more, especially for those dogs that are poorly regulated or they have weird somogies or it's really hard to get compliance. So if you see that insulin on a report, again, that's just emerging into our space, but certainly maybe something that we see more in the future.
And what other innovations are on the horizon?
Oh my gosh, it's so cool. So in October of 24, we actually had the first insulin pump placed on a patient in canine space. Obviously very common in the human world. That's certainly the future for us, right? If we have a closed loop system where something is sensing our patient's interstitial blood sugar reading and then actively administering insulin based on that reading. Amazing, yeah, right? And huge. Certainly that's coming. It's certainly still in studies, pilot studies, but we did have that first successful patient. So that's coming. In the human space, you know, there are breathalyzer tests for blood sugar readings. They're developing technology that even something like an Apple Watch could sense. So non-invasive blood sugar readings, probably a ways down the line for us. However, two cool new blood tests that are there's testing. Biomarkers are the future, right? In diagnostic space, we're very familiar with a biomarker that's changed the way we practice in renal disease, SDMA, right? So we're looking at that now, chronic inflammatory changes in dogs. So looking at CD4 and CD40 plus T helper cells, looking at TNF alpha and IL-6, so cytokines that are released in obese patients. There's a study that showed that our diabetics have really high vitamin D. So could there be some nutritional modifications there? And there's also a study at Royal Veterinary College right now looking at DGGR lipase. It's a very specific lipase for subclinical pancreatitis. We know a lot of these dogs have concurrent pancreatitis, and obviously is that the chicken or the egg, which came first? We think the pancreatitis did, but we often have no way of diagnosing it before it's clinical. So can we identify, screen these dogs, the high-risk breeds like Samoyeds and Schnauzers, sorry, Dachshunds again, Bichons, Labs, don't forget Labs, high-risk. So can we screen these breeds for DGGR lipase and find it? And we're finding, at least in that study, 30% of our diabetics positive subclinical pancreatitis. So looking at all of these to come so we can have better regulation, most importantly, support those pet parents.
Yeah. You want more of a proactive approach to something like this before it's too late, like you're just talking about.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. And that's why it's certainly for us as veterinary teams, what I'd love for you to take away from this podcast is the earlier we can educate, the better.
Absolutely.
You know, if you've got one of these high-risk breeds coming in as a puppy, we don't want to do a scare tactic in the exam room. But it's important, so many first-time pet parents from COVID, to say, look, I'm not sure if you're aware, but your dog is a high-risk breed potentially for diabetes down the line. What does that mean for us today? Just that.
Yeah,
just be aware. But maybe they want to think about different strategies for payment for those pets. Pet health insurance, pet some of the savings plans, other, you know, savings accounts. Rising cost of care, you know, it's not going to change dramatically, right? But how can we educate and inform as early as possible so that if by chance their schnauzer 6 years down the road becomes a diabetic, it's not a surprise. You know, they're not going to be happy necessarily because nobody wants that for their dog, but it's certainly not going to have that level of shock. Right. They're going to be a little bit more prepared, and maybe along the way they're asking questions about it. So if it does happen, they're ready to go. It's not a month of shock.
Right. Absolutely. Right? Fantastic information, Dr. Donnelly Marks. This is one. And by the way, we're live here at Fetch Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri. We're at the Adipet booth here, which is fantastic. So lots of great information for you to check them out online as well. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thanks to our friends at Adipet as well for supporting this conversation. Don't forget to rate the podcast as we continue to grow. And we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast podcast. Take care, everyone.